are, a cultural studies reading of Blade Runner that's going to be a bit different. We're going to start with just, how many of you guys have seen Blade Runner before last night's show, him?
Okay.
Pretty much everybody, you know. And how many of you have heard, you know, the idea that Blade Runner is just one of those science fiction films that you have to see? It's just one of those sci-fi films that's pivotal. So, you know, it's okay, so it's a good number. And I was going to say whether or not you guys agree with me. I've been told since I was a wee little secret girl that Blade Runner was one of those foundational films for science fiction. It's one of the things you have to see if you really want to know what science fiction is. So the question for me, and this is often a question I run with, is why is this film so influential? Why is it recommended so much? Why is the notion of a director's cut? And as one of the five people in America who saw the original cut first, I'm not going to say that it's overrated, but I don't know a better way to invest it. But anyway, I'm asking what, in other words, sets off the pay attention to this film as an academic thing and just as a science fiction thing along. And I admit, this is what I do as a scholar and as your average hobbyist. Why are these things, why is it that it's Blade Runner and not Brazil that's going to be the natural on your syllabus? Why is it that 1,000 people are going to recommend, you know, this film over that film? And a lot of it, I discovered, is it has to do with a notion that Martin McLuhan, who's a very famous media theorist, calls a hybrid and the energy that hybrids bring. Sometimes this kind of hybrid energy is a cross between media. And one of the things that I've done really recently is talk about Moulin Rouge, because it's music video hits film, the film musical, which is a whole special thing all in itself, hits Indian popular cinema, and it was just this thing. And it didn't do too well at the box office either, but everybody was like, Moulin Rouge, Moulin Rouge, the Tam Tam Tam! So, in the case of Blade Runner, it's not so much about a hybrid medium, because this is pretty much a film that's an adaptation of a novel, but what it is about hybrid film genre, and how Blade Runner kind of signals a radical change in the popular imagination about what science fiction is, and it kind of clears the landscape for a new stream in science fiction, and in some extent the popular culture. Blade Runner signals this whole new thing that we call cyberpunk. So what am I going to spew at you for the next 45 to 50 minutes while you're saying, just to finish up, girl, so that we can get our papers in and just go home? What kind of crapped out graduate student, Meg, am I going to spew at you? Basically, it comes down to three big points. And I could probably talk much longer, but I'm not going to because I'm not that mean. You cannot have Blade Runner without the idea of noir. And that is both roman noir, which is the written kind of noir, and the genre known as film noir, which is just the American film genre that everybody loves to like drool over. But I think in a lot of ways, Blade Runner visually and structurally is more of a film noir than what we traditionally associate with science fiction. Point number two, the science fiction in Blade Runner works primarily because it takes all of the things that we say make up good science fiction up to this point, all of the things that are important about science fiction, and it stomps on them. And it tells them that it tells all of the things like robots and futures that are usually bright and rosy, takes them and says, you know what? No, and you're going to like it. And it takes only the parts of science fiction it thinks are interesting, and it tells us kind of whatever you call hard science fiction that would be exemplified by 2001, on the one hand, particularly the artistic hand, and on the other hand, the monster in the closet that we haven't talked about, Star Wars, which came out in 1977 and made $1 billion and kind of put sci-fi in everybody's mind. But it takes me to, and it kind of tells you that it's this. Anyway, point number three, and you know why I care about Blade Runner, is that Blade Runner changes everything. It changes the way that we think about science fiction in the popular imagination, in print, in film, and to some extent in television. Nothing is ever quite the same. I mean, despite the fact that all of the old ways of science fiction chug along quite profitably all throughout the 80s and 90s and now, we don't think about science fiction in the same way ever again after Blade Runner. So, you know, here we go. Part one, the noir aesthetic and what it means. So, some probably the best way to start you off with what film noir is, and this is deeply under contention, is to define the canonical period of it. It starts in 1941 with the film The Maltese Falcon, which is a Humphrey Bogart movie, features the directorial debut of John Huston, who is Angelica Huston's father. And in it, I was told the best place to put a bookend on the classic phase of noir is 1958 with Orson Welles' film Touch of Evil, which is Charlton Heston, and I can't remember the girl. She was one of the Hitchcock girls, and I can't remember if it was Kim Novak or, no, it was the girl from Psycho, I think.
Janet Leigh?
Yeah, it was Janet Leigh, I think. Anyway, film noir, in many ways, takes a lot from pulp novels, and look, we're right back in formula fiction. It's so cool. You know, the pulp novel, it flourishes in the 1920s, the 1930s, and the 1940s. And the authors that everybody thinks of are, you know, typically Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, Davidson Kay, a whole bunch of other guys who I forgot. And people just love these novels. They sounded like this. This is the kind of way that they sounded. And this is from the very, very famous novel, The Big Sleep, which was 1939. The room was too big, the ceiling was too high, the doors were too tall, and the white carpet that went from wall to wall looked like a fresh fall of snow at Lake Arrowhead. There were full-length mirrors and crystal doodads all over the place. The ivory furniture had chromium on it, and the enormous ivory drapes lay tumbled on the white carpet a yard from the window. The white made the ivory look dirty, and the ivory made the white look bled out. The window stared toward the darkening foothills. It was going to rain soon. There was pressure in the air already. And even in this little thing, which is not the most Chandler-esque of moments, we kind of get the noir touches. We've got the Los Angeles setting. We've got these deeply described kind of dense settings around us that kind of tinge towards the grungy. And then we've got the rain in Southern California. Lots and lots of rain. If you wondered why, it's like, why is it raining in Blade Runner in the future? Wouldn't it be more realistic to say, it's been a 20-year drought? I grew up during the big drought, too, so rain in Los Angeles is particularly amusing to me. And other things that the noir films and novels have that should set off warning signs in your mind when you're thinking about Blade Runner is they tend to have a male detective protagonist who does not have a good relationship with the cop. You know, he tends to be this kind of normal guy. He usually works in a world full of colorful lowlife, doesn't really have much money, and he almost always, during the course of the case, gets the crap kicked out of him. Like, just bam, bam, bam. And meanwhile, the woman in these stories, she tends to be wealthy, she tends to be glamorous, and she tends to have a secret that can almost endue her and the detective hero. And another point is the detective hero is almost what we like to call an anti-hero. He does violent things. He does frequently creepy things. In one film, Laura, he was actually a cop in this one, but he falls in love with a dead woman's portrait because he thinks the woman is dead, and he becomes obsessed with this woman's portrait. He's just falling in love with this woman who's dead through her portrait. That kind of creepy thing. And sometimes he's a selfish pig. If you ever read the Mike Hammernot book or seen like Kissing Deadly, he's often a misogynist, selfish pig who's slapping women around. And he's looking out for him. But despite that, it's particularly in Chandler. We like him anyway. So on the one hand, I've kind of just listed point by point the textual elements that are noir in Blade Runner. Deckard does get him, you know, does get the crap kicked out of him, particularly by Roy. But everybody seems to slap him around. Rachel is, you know, very femme fatale, and I was going to look and link at my website, but I don't feel like switching over the computer and switching back to show you a couple of pictures. But she really does look an amazing amount like some of the classic actresses in film noir, like Barbara Stanwyck or, you know, Jean Tierney. And we've got this Los Angeles set, and it's a miserable Los Angeles in a lot of ways, where these people are all kind of harboring this secret. The cops are jerks. The ending does not fill you with glee, even in the original upbeat ending. Them wandering around in the hills in a car, but not quite them happily ever after. We don't feel any thrill of redemption for our protagonist. But then on the other hand, I'd like to show you a couple of the visual elements. So I'm going to start with this sequence from Blade Runner and then show another bit from The Maltese Falcon. And it's not quite as dark as some of the really big noirs are, but Maltese will kind of show you where I'm you. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he told you what he did.
Talk to him.
He would see me.
Gift of noir movies. film industry in general. But there's a lot to visually link these two. But that's the joke. Why did Ridley Scott decide to turn Do Androids Dream of Electric City into this movie that's so noir sci-fi? If this period is 1941 to 1958, this genre is 20, 30 years out of date. So what do you see in noir that's relevant to a 1982 audience who's watching a sci-fi movie? And next part is, I think that the answer lies in how Scott handles the science fiction element of the film and what he's reacting to within science fiction as a genre. And so this is part two, something over science fiction and teaching them to like it. Now, the thing that's interesting to me is that we go at Blade Runner as a science fiction film. And of course, it's obviously science fiction in form. You've got the futuristic setting. You've got the robots who aren't really robots. There's flying cars. Fine note of a futuristic society since like 1930. The technology is much more advanced, except that the one thing that's missing from this film is that there's no striving towards scientific accuracy or the loving description of the technology. Blade Runner is more or less, it's there if you're looking for details. No one explains where the replicants came from. They just come from the Tyrell Corporation. People just make their eyes. They don't explain how that works. They don't explain how people have gotten off-world into this thriving off-world colony thing by 2019. That's just the way it is. And then you compare that to, say, 2001. The science there is on display in this hardcore, you know, in central way. You can't escape the technology in 2001. It revolves around the technology of space travel, the science of it. Now, so is Blade Runner, in a way. But the way science fiction moves is completely different. And I think it's why Ridley Scott, and I guess Philip K. Dick, I haven't read the book in a while, play up this noir act. They're not interested in hitting you over the head with the technology for their big points, whatever they are, right? Or are they just doing the reverse psychology thing, setting you up for the fall? And I think the answer is yes. I think there are two answers to the way that Blade Runner handles science fiction. On the one hand, it's kind of the punk answer to the big, clean, wide, streamlined futures in space that we see in films like 2001 and probably much more relevantly, Star Wars. Think about this, too. The last film that Ridley Scott did before Blade Runner was Alien, which I should have brought for Cliff. That's good now because I'm short on time. But it's Alien more clearly. If you know the plot of that film, it's kind of more the obvious reply to where people in space are always, they're always really well-trained scientists. They're extraordinary in some way. They're extraordinary in 2001. They're extraordinary in Star Wars. In Alien, the people are more or less intergalactic truckers trying to get their money while as they're bringing stuff back to Earth. So Ridley Scott, in a way, is definitely responding to this, okay, this is based on always these extraordinary people who are doing extraordinary things in space. And Blade, you know, and I always bring up 2001 because I don't think it's possible to make a serious science fiction film after 2001 without it being in the back of your head, like, seriously. And so Ridley Scott is definitely obsessed with the idea that normal people can be in science fiction. People who have, pretty much the way I thought of it is, people who have day jobs have rarely been, normal day jobs that we recognize have rarely been in science fiction. They're always extremely special in some way. Nobody in Decker's world is obsessed with science for science's sake. Not even J.F. Sebastian. He has all of this knowledge and all of this facility with technology, and he uses it to make toys to make sense because he's lonely. None of the people in Blade Runner, not even Decker, nobody wants to save the world from the evil empire. Decker is pretty damn normal. Whether or not he decides he's a replicant, you know. Decker's pretty normal from what we've seen himself. He has a job. He has to pay the telephone when he gets hung up on. He lives in a dirty apartment where he hasn't done the dishes. He eats noodles. He can't even speak the language of half the people in his city. He's not abnormal. This is really interesting considering it's Harrison Ford. It's Han Solo. But he's eating noodles in Los Angeles and getting beat up by people who are much, much stronger than him. He's doing a very good job, a very morally complex job that the society around him will not allow to be morally complex. They're replicants, they're retired, they're not even executed. And that's even more complicated if you think he's a which Ridley Scott has said that he is, but I'm not even entirely convinced of that. So my thought is that Blade Runner is kind of this vanguard of science fiction in a world where not everybody is in love with science. It's not Star Trek, where everybody has decided upon a career in science. It's not 2001, where it's astronauts specially trained. This is kind of how fabulous new technology appears to people who have to pay their mortgage, or people who just have to figure out how to get enough money to do. After all, replicants are banned on Earth. And what are they part of? They're part of this whole, you know, replicants are smarter than they are. They're better looking. They're healthier. Dan Sebastian is kind of awestruck by Chris and Roy. He just thinks you guys are just so much better than everything that's left on Earth. And they get to go off world. And it's implied heavily that most of the people on Earth are not going to get to go off world. And it's not just for money. It's because they've mutated somehow. Dan Sebastian can't go off world because he's just too sick. And despite the fact that the replicants lead, despite the fact that the way to kill a replicant, as compared to the way to kill Hal, or the way to kill any of the iRobot robots, is a lot different. When he shoots them, they're dead. It's not all of that different from killing a human. And note Rachel's pointed question, have you ever retired a human? And you know in your job. But at the same time, they don't even get the dignity of somebody asking questions. They see you, they know you're a replicant, you're dead. They don't even get the dignity of it being called death. They have it called retirement. So all of a sudden, we've got these aliens, these others, who are completely indistinguishable from humans, more or less, without the use of a very complicated test that is getting less effective with every iteration of robots. The difference between the humans and the replicants is minuscule at best, but it causes the most violent response. Instead of giving them the benefit of the doubt or, you know, just taking care of the higher brain functions, it's three shots to the chest. Killing Chris while she's, like, lying there screaming with one hole through her. She's going to die anyway. But, you know, Deckard shoots her a couple more times before she stops screaming. The thing about Blade Runner that I think is, you know, very relevant is the technology is not shoved in your face. It's alien. It's not, you know, it's not shoved in your face as alien, different, not human. But you can't stop thinking about the replicant. Or you can't stop looking around at Los Angeles and thinking, it's always raining, it's always dirty, and the people who aren't replicants, they don't look so good. They don't look so healthy. So instead of being distracted by the technology's viability, the possibility that it's working, people can focus on the world the technology and the others have given to the humans on Earth. And not great humans, not particularly even nice humans. Deckard's boss is kind of a slime ball, for instance. You know, a lot of the people in the Blade Runner world are kind of sick. They're abnormal in some ways. Tyrell is not the nicest guy because he's head crushed, right? That's neither here nor there. But I think what the great thing about Blade Runner is and what it changed about science fiction is it makes it easier to see that science fiction is about the anxiety of the world around us. We could talk about War of the Worlds being about imperialism, but it's so abstracting because these are Martians. And on the level, you just want to say, they're Martians, damn it. They're not colonized Africans asking for liberation from their colonial masters. But it's a lot easier to see that scene of Chris walking down the streets of Los Angeles, dressed kind of like your runaway homeless teen punk girl, and kind of see where suddenly it's the 80s. And yes, there are concerns about the homeless. Yes, there are concerns about where teen girls go to sleep at night. And Chris already talked about the cultural anxieties about Japan and all the other good stuff. But these things are a lot easier to see and a lot harder to say, you're nuts. They're just Martians, damn it. They're just imperial stormtroopers. So it's different. It makes things different because it doesn't focus on the amazing of the development that go wrong. Things are already messed up when you get to Blade Runner. Hal doesn't go crazy. Things aren't great until the technology breaks down or something. Things are already messed up, and they only get worse or better compared to what the protagonist does, which is why it really makes sense to me to cast it in the noir as idiot. Because film noir, on a basic level, is all about the dysfunctional world that's trying to be understood by a hero that's broken in some way or other. And there are not any simple answers about how to fix it. You can't just tear the brain out of Hal and move on. But in any case, it's a new paradigm in science fiction. And it changed things, asking how in the last 5 minutes of class here. So we got Blade Runner. Neo-noir science fiction add your own title to make it longer. And after Blade Runner, you've got this entirely new genre. Well, not entirely new, but people view it as new. And it's the word cyberpunk. And what you have to think about as the early 1980s in science fiction is what starts to happen. And it's different from what the marketplace gave you. People were just fine with hard science fiction and out there worlds where people were doing interesting things who are extraordinary. But literary science fiction in the 1980s kind of tends to begin with and end with cyberpunk. And literary cyberpunk starts with William Gibson's Neuromancer. And that came out in 1980. But between Gibson and Blade Runner, most of the terminology of science fiction has significantly shifted. So not until the 1990s does this really hit the mainstream that things have changed. So what happens in science fiction, briefly? We've got a noticeable shift in where technology goes. Technology isn't nearly as big and metallic anymore. The classic metal, all-metal robots have tended to become cyborgs, even those with the metal structure, like in Terminator. They look human on the outside. Humans start to have implants. You know, technology and science are not the way to save the world. Again, all the technology in Blade Runner hasn't made Earth into a paradise. It's a junk. It's industrial technology has grasped the Earth, and nobody seems to care or expect technology to save it. Computers and robots start to have more space between them, which is an obvious development of the microcomputer and home computing as a viable thing. The AIs, Neuromancer, Snow Crash, and the Matrix are less interested in this, in the physical world. And they're more interested in these worlds that they're making. And unfortunately, Blade Runner doesn't really have great computers, but that's okay because it's not all things cyberpunk. And of course, this is not a magical invention of Ridley Scott. Even George Lucas, 1980, Empire is obviously a lot darker than the original Star Wars. So there's cultural currents going around. You can't just say, Ridley Scott is a genius, and he made science fiction dark. No, he just gave us the best example to focus on. He gave us the best example of a new aesthetic. And sci-fi film immediately reacts. This is Terminator. This is Brazil. This is Alien, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They get darker. Television, because television is a very slow medium to change, it takes a longer time to have Blade Runner kind of change it. But the early 1990s, you start seeing, especially now that the digital revolution is really starting to percolate in people's heads, you get the X-Files, which looks really a lot darker. It's kind of like Blade Runner, where you can't see a damn thing. The content might not be much different, but you can't see a damn thing in the show. Again, with the look. Comics and graphic art did a much better job with this. Ghost in the Shell, that kind of a thing. They all kind of reacted to the change fairly quickly. My conclusion is, somebody once told me, life is Blade Runner, the rest is just details. And I think in many ways she's right. There's this significant shift in the way our futures were portrayed after Blade Runner. Hell, even Star Trek, that most optimistic of franchises, gives us its darkest press. In the early 90s, after this whole cyberpunk thing has gone through, we got Deep Space Nine. And the meaning of what science fiction was all about shifted a great deal. In some ways, it's long overdue, and it allows for significant new voices. But my final thought is, Blade Runner kind of took something out of science fiction. So it's darker, it's more realistic. But what about the wonder? What about the optimistic future? Does Blade Runner kill it? I don't know. And I don't know.